Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo Maheshwaraha, Guru Sakshat Parabrahma, Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. We were just saying during the break, a couple of inner searchers came and said, you know, I've heard all this, of course, a dozen times, but it kind of went a little bit deeper this time because Bodhinatha was saying it, and I was reflecting with them on how much communication is related more to an ambiance and to a fuller, subtle reception of knowledge and feeling and knowing, and something we can learn in a book is one level, but when we learn it from someone who knows it or who's gone through it, it's a totally different animal. And so that's what we're experiencing, you know. Bodhidharma saying, oh, ho hum, ho hum, ho hum, but because of all of his years of sadhana and teaching and training, it goes deeper. So, do you have that little picture of karma? I have a very low-key, low-tech class, but it has one picture. That's it. It's a picture of overcoming our karmas. And I wanted to start with the reflection of something that Gurudeva gave us. He gave us this marvelous trilogy of knowledge. But what you may not have cognized, and I want to bring forward for you, is that if you study the trilogy and understand the trilogy, you will have, without knowing it, you will have mastered the Agamas and the Vedas. You'll have mastered the Tirukkural and Tirumandaram. You'll have mastered the understanding of Saiva Siddhanta that people teach in books like this that are very complicated, very erudite, very dense, opaque. And Gurudeva brought all of these things into this one little world, very carefully assembled it, compiled it, and then articulated it in our language, in English language. That's all the language we teach in. And so by studying this one source, you actually become an expert, knowledgeable person in all of these other sources at the same time. So just a little observation for us. So I want to talk about karma. Anybody have any karma left? Yeah. I want to talk about karma, and I want to tell a few stories that are meant to give you each in your life maybe a new way to face karma, a new easiness about our karma, because as your laughter indicated, we all are going through these karmas of different kinds, and karmas wax and wane like the weather. And but when they get hard is when we need the knowledge and the tools. When they're easy, who needs knowledge and tools when everything's going good, right? So we're going to talk about some stories that are true stories, Gurudeva stories, and I want you not just to listen to the story, but to listen to why I'm telling the story. There's two different things happening. I'm telling a story, but I'm also, I chose this story for a reason. So karma. On the pillars at Iravan Temple, we have four carvings over in the northwest corner. And one carving is an archer from the back with a quiver full of arrows. And then the next panel shows an archer like this, with arrow ready to fly. And the next shows the arrow in flight. And then there's a fourth one that shows a broken arrow. So what does that represent? This is, by the way, an ancient Indian metaphor for karma. It's not something that we made up. You find this in the scripture. So the quiver of arrows are all of, they call sanchita karma, which are all of the karmas that we have in past, present, and future births. All of the cumulative karmas that we have to go through on this great, marvelous, divine path. They're all there. Then you take, the second one is he takes one arrow out, and then those are the basically the kriyamana, not the kriyamana, the prarabdha karmas of this life. So in this life you will only take out a number of those arrows, not all of them. And in each life, we take out a few of our arrows and we let them fly. And so those are the prarabdha arrows. And then the one in flight is traditionally regarded as kriyamana. It's the one that's happening. Gurudeva interpreted a little bit differently. He took that kriyamana karma as a the karmas we create in this life. So not all karmas. If you had all of them in the quiver when you first started evolving, that would be a form of predestination or fate, which we don't believe in. So we have certain karmas that we create. We didn't bring them into this life, but because we reacted to something negatively or ignorantly, well, then we created a new karma, and you know how that goes. And then the broken one is when the karma is done with. When you've finished it, completed it, and settled that one, and that's the broken arrow. So those are the kinds of karmas that we have. So mostly we're talking about this one today. Not so much what you create, although indirectly by our reactions, those karmas come to play. So my basic premise today is this, is that we don't have really very much power over what happens to us in life. Things happen. Other people bring karmas to us, experiences to us, our community, our whatever, family. We don't have a lot of control over that, which is okay. Why? Because we do have complete control over our response to whatever happens to us in life. So how we react to a karmic incident is sitting right here in the palm of your hand. I can insult you, and you have lots of ways of responding. Oh, poor Swami, he has a cold, he's in a bad mood. I'll bring him some tea and everything will be okay. Or you can say, oh my God, he probably saw something that I never told anybody. Oh, this is terrible. You can beat yourself up over that. Both are common responses to something that happens to us, right? But what you do in response to my insulting you is right here in the palm of your hand. You control that. Nobody else in the world controls that. Nobody. Nobody. So that gives you the power of the complete control of your destiny and the complete control of the direction of your karma in this life. So if we went one way, oh, poor Swami, and you respond to my insult with love, your whole life goes in a certain direction. If we respond in the other way, oh, my God, I'm a this, I'm a that, I did that, and you beat yourself up, your whole energy and life goes in another direction. And where does that, the pivot of that is all inside of you. And then that's kind of the essence of the stories that I'm going to tell you. So the first story is an inner search story. I'm thinking every day if I'm smart, I can start with an inner search story. I don't know if I can do it. True story. So we're having inner search, a small one, about 35 people, I think, and we were in San Francisco at the time. And we're having dinner at a place called the Carnelian Room. That's the name of the restaurant. And it's on the 52nd floor of the tallest, it was then the tallest building in San Francisco. I think the pyramid is taller now, but this is pre-pyramid. So 52nd floor, beautiful, very fancy restaurant. And we've gone through all of the courses and we're up to the dessert. And Gurudeva says, well, let's, the specialty of the chef here is baked Alaska. And so let's have baked Alaska for everybody. And if those of you who know baked Alaska, it's this big fiery dessert. I guess they put brandy on it, something like that. Thank you. So, this very Germanic waiter is managing our table, and he rolls up a cart, and it has all the ice cream and the brandy and whatever else you do with those things, and he starts to make our dessert. And so at one point he pours the bottle of brandy into this pan, I think it was a pan with a fire underneath, and the whole thing blows up. And the fire escapes the pan, falls on our table and on the carpet of the restaurant. So here we are on the 52nd floor, you know, where's the exit? And the room's on fire. And so Gurudeva was very calm, and everyone would naturally look to Gurudeva like, should we run, or what should happen? And Gurudeva just sat there calmly. This waiter, he had a white towel on his arm, and he reached over, just so calm, so unemotional, reached over, and he went whamp whamp on the table and whamp 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 on the floor, put the towel back on his arm, and started making our baked Alaska. So later I thought to myself, wow, what a great waiter. What a marvelous waiter. What a beautiful response. And then I thought to myself, wait a minute, this is the only guy who spilled things on the floor. He's not that great a waiter, right? He's the guy who messed it up. But no, his response actually made me respect him more than if he hadn't made the mistake. If he hadn't made the mistake, I probably wouldn't have even noticed him. I'd have eaten my dessert and gone home. But because this was a really serious blunder with potential for, you know, harm, and because he was so good at responding to it, I thought he was the better waiter for it. So think to yourself for a minute, why would Swami tell me that story? So it shows, we have the ability to respond to whatever happens to us. He could have responded in a panicky way and it would have looked really bad. But he responded in a very professional and marvelous, disciplined way. And so that was within his hand to respond to that disaster. Second story. So this story goes back to when we were monks, young monks in Virginia City, Nevada. We were up at like 7,000 feet. We had bought an old brewery, and we were living in a three-story brewery, where Mark Twain used to drink beer, by the way. And and he was the editor of the Territorial Enterprise in the nearby village. So we were there. I was really young monk, much younger than these old monks here. And I was in the kitchen one day at lunch, and I was the chef for that day, and I was chopping vegetables. And when I chop vegetables, one of my principles is I want a really sharp knife, because that's the way to chop vegetables. You don't never want to chop vegetables with a dull knife. That's somehow wrong. So I had a really sharp knife, and I managed to use that really sharp knife to cut deeply into my index finger. I can still see the scar here, deeply enough that that there was blood shooting up, you know, like this high, all over the kitchen, and I stopped it, and I wrapped it all up, and I got a Band-Aid, and then I started going through my reaction to what I had done. So I'm young, and I'm not very mature, and so my reaction isn't very mature either. And my reaction is something like this. Why in the world weren't you paying more attention? What's the matter with you? You're on the meditative path. You're supposed to be conscious at all times and present. And how can you cut yourself so badly in the kitchen? That shouldn't have happened. That was part of my reaction. This should not have happened. This is wrong. And I was so sorry about it. I was just getting sad and probably reacting to the physical trauma also. So I went to Gurudeva. I said, Gurudeva, I don't know what to think about this. I shouldn't have done it. I know that. I should know better. I should be more careful. And Gurudeva just looked at me with this big eyes, and he said, you're looking at this all the wrong way. I said, I am. You're looking at this just all the wrong way. He says, you're a monk in my order, and you're living in this holy ashram, and you're doing this marvelous work, and something happened. Now, if you were out in the world, you might have cut off your finger. You might have lost your arm. Some karma was there for you to go through. And because you're with me and you're meditating and you're living a pure life, and because of that, all it was a little cut on your finger. Look at just a little Band-Aid on your finger, you know. So you should really be thankful that you just had this little cut. So I went away, and I went away with this thing, I'm so happy I cut myself. What a great thing. How the guru could take that karma, you could see the road I was going down. It was a very well-trod road of misery and you know, I was beating myself up. And Gurudeva took that, and he made me happy that I had cut myself. What a gift he had to take something like that and transform it. And what was he doing? He was teaching me how to deal with karma, when it comes into my life. He was teaching me a very important lesson in a very simple way. Of course, it was up to me to listen to the lesson that he was teaching me and remember it, which I did. But he was gifting me a karmic tool that I've used my whole life. All the rest of my life, I've used this knowledge that he gave me on that day for other things that came about. You know, just mostly like little physical things or getting hammered by somebody or something like that. But that's an important thing to know, that because you're on the path, your karmas are also ameliorated and softened some. So next time something happens to you, you can say, oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness that happened to me. It could have been worse. It could have been a lot worse. But it wasn't. And so, and that response of gratitude in those situations changes the whole experience, obviously, from a lot of drama, you know, to a lot of understanding. It's my second story. Is this fun? So one of the things that I tell people when they come with problems, because one of the joys of my profession and Bodhinanda's profession is we get to hear a lot of problems, which is wonderful, because you get to understand humanity and human nature so marvelously and so profoundly. So when people come and they have a problem, I don't tell them right away, but I think to myself right away, oh, I wonder what the gift card is. And then after they go through the problem and come out the other side, then I ask them, well, what was the gift card? And they say, what do you mean? I say, well, what was the gift card? Every suffering comes with a gift card. We just don't open it up until later. We'll find out what it was. But every suffering comes with a gift card. So what was the gift card? So I'm going to tell you a gift card story. So this is pretty recent, actually. It's just in the last 24 months. Very beautiful, wonderful, spiritual woman that we know came to me, and she said, I have breast cancer. And she was pretty young to have breast cancer. So I said, well, tell me about it. And so she started talking about it. The more she talked, the more I could see the fear welling up inside of her. I mean, it's natural, you know. What's going to happen? Am I going to die? Am I going to have surgery? So she went through that. So I said to her, I said, okay, we're going to go through this experience. This is our karma that has come. We didn't choose it, but nevertheless, it's here and in front of us. I said, what you have to do is you have to be very, very careful not to get drawn into the fear chakra. The fear chakra is way down there, as Bodhinanda is pointing out, way down there. You can't get drawn into the fear chakra, and the fact is that society and medicine is conspiring to bring you into fear. And the doctor is going to bring you into the room, and he's going to give you a diagnosis, and he's going to have a big sad look on his face, and he's going to tell you all the things that he has to do, and he's going to make you afraid, and he wants you to be afraid in a sense, not consciously, but he wants you to be afraid, because then he thinks you'll take action and you'll do all the things that he wants you to do. You know, so don't go into fear. fear is not going to help any karma, and certainly not going to help this one. If you have fear in your consciousness, then you're sending, endorphin biochemical messages to every cell of your body. Fear, 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 and then the cells start thinking, uh-oh, and we don't. That's the wrong message. What we want them to do is get to work and say, okay, I can do this. So I said, don't go into fear. So then we went through the whole process, which included surgeries and things like that. And then I met her a couple of months ago when we were traveling. Santonada Swami and I were traveling. I met her, and she said, oh, I have to tell you something. I said, well, what's that? She said, remember you told me not to have any fear as I went through the cancer experience? And I said, yes. She said, well, I really worked on that. I really had to work on that because I was really basically debilitated by my fear of this whole thing. And I had to consciously fight that fear, and I did that. And in the process, I learned something. So during my meditations, as I was going through the cancer, during my meditations, I realized that the cancer was, in fact, a part of my own fear of the past. And I realized that every moment of my life, I was afraid of something. I was afraid of criticism. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of poverty. I was afraid to have a child, and then I was afraid I wouldn't have a child. And then I was afraid, and I was afraid, I was afraid, I was afraid, I was afraid. She said, as the more I looked at fear, the more I realized it had pervaded every corner of my life. And now, I have no fear left. She said, I could die right now. So that was the gift card that she got from going through cancer. She was relieved of a whole life burden of fear. And I told her, I said, that's a pretty good exchange. If you think about it, that's a pretty good deal that you made. So karma's always, my perception of the universe is Shiva is always at work in our life. Even when it doesn't look like he's at work in our life. And so when things are going wrong, we can always say, well, maybe they're not going wrong. Maybe this is how they're supposed to go. And then maybe I'm supposed to learn something from this and grow from this, mature spiritually from this. And so that's a good thing to know. Tell you a more cheerful story. So this is the Inner Church story. So this story is about how, you know how Ganesha, Gurudeva says, works not in a straight line, but with a swastika, you know, it takes you here, then takes you here, then finally you get to where you're supposed to be. So in 1969, we were on an Inner Search, and we were flown into Kathmandu from Calcutta in nine little airplanes. There were 65 of us, and they could only take a few in each of these little prop planes. And so they flew us from Calcutta into Kathmandu, and then this was December, so it's really cold. There's snow and ice on the ground in Kathmandu. And we checked into the Grand Oberoi Hotel. And it was grand, yeah, it was grand. I mean, when the Oberois make a grand hotel, they make a grand hotel. But because it was December, We were the only clients that the hotel had. We had the whole hotel to ourselves, and probably had 1,000 rooms. And you know, we're using 30 of them or something. And the ceilings in the rooms were almost as high as this tent. This Victorian architecture, big fireplace in each room, which was important because that they don't have central heating, they have heating from the fireplace. So we went into the room and we unpacked our bags and Guru Deva says, "Little bit chilly here." I said, "Yeah, it's cold." He said, "Well, go down and we don't see any firewood or anything in the room. Go down and see if they have some coal or some firewood that you could start a little fire, warm my room up." I said, "Sure." So I went down. The staff was pretty minimal at this because we were minimal in their eyes, I guess. And so I went down and the manager was in his office. I knocked on his door and I introduced myself as the coordinator. And I said, "You know, the rooms are really cold and how can we get some coal or some firewood?" He said, "You can't." I said, "What do you mean? That can't be right. You don't understand. All these people are in their rooms and it's freezing in these rooms. It's winter and I don't know, what, 7,000 feet in the Himalayas or something crazy?" And he said, "No, you can't. We don't have it for you." So I said, "Okay." And I went back to Gurudeva and I said, "Mr. Gupta told me we're not going to get any firewood." And Gurudeva said, "Well, that's impossible. That we can't have the inner searchers freeze to death in Nepal. How would that look on our resume? 65 perish in the Kathmandu." You go down and tell him that we have to have firewood. There's just no option about it. And so I went back down. I said, "Mr. Gupta, there's just no choice here. We have to find some firewood. You know, can I help? Can we go out and hire some? Or, you know, what can we do?" And he said, "You people, you blue-eyed white people, come to my country and pretend to know something about yoga, pretend to call yourself Hindus, and you come here and you demand of me that I give you firewood. So just go back to your room." Whoa. So I went back to the room, reported that little conversation to someone you all know. And Gurudeva said, "Okay, you go back to Mr. Gupta." It's easier now, right? You go back to Mr. Gupta and you tell Mr. Gupta, "Look, if we don't get coal or firewood and keep these wonderful people warm, we're going to walk out of your hotel and we're going to go somewhere else. And that's not going to look good for you." So I went down, "Mr. Gupta, if you don't give us firewood, we're going to go somewhere else." And he laughed and he said, "Where are you going to go? Your planes all went back to Calcutta. They're not scheduled to come here for 9 days. There's not another hotel in the city that's open in December. We opened it for you. There's no place to go, so go back to your room." So I went back to my room. I told Gurudeva that conversation. And he said, "Okay, here's what we'll do. You go find a place for us to stay for the next 9 days. So I'm not going to stay in this hotel." With this man and his attitude and everything, we don't belong here. We're gonna, you go find us another place. So off I went, little taxi, racing around Kathmandu. And he was right, there was nothing. There was no hotel that I could find. And so then I thought, well, I'll go ask some of the mountaineers here. There are people who live here. They must know something. So I'll go ask the mountaineers. And there was an institute. It was called the Tenzin Gezi Mountain Himalayan Climbers Institute. And Tenzin Gezi was the fellow who went up, I think, with, was it Hillary? The first time. So I went to the Tenzin Gezi Institute and I said, we have 65 people who need a place to stay for 9 days. Do you know of such a place? Not really. I said, there has to be some place. I mean, it could be fairly simple, but we're a little bit desperate here. And he said, oh, okay. So, well, there's this base camp at Sandakpu. It's at 13,500 feet, and there's nobody there because it's not the climbing season. And there's two bunkhouses, which could, I think they had like room for 80 people, bunkhouses. And I could arrange for you to rent that place. I said, do it. That's perfect. And I said, well, what will we need to live there? You know, well, you'll need this kind of down sleeping bag that, you know, goes down to minus 274 degrees Celsius. It's really cold up there. And you'll need this food, and because there's no kitchen there, so you'll need wood to cook on a, you know, pots and normal village kind of cooking. And there's no plumbing, so you'll be washing in a little pond that's up there, a frozen pond. You have to break the ice to get into the frozen water to put it on yourself at 13,500 feet. I said, okay. So I went back to Gurudeva and I told him that we found a place. He said, okay, go shopping and get us whatever transportation we need. So I went and I hired 16 Jeeps and I went shopping for 65 people for nine days, three meals a day. And so after about 4 or 5 hours, I pulled up. Gurudev had instructed me what to do. He said, I want you to pull all of the Jeeps up into right in front of the lobby. Okay, so I pulled all the Jeeps up in front of the lobby. He said, now I want all of the inner searchers to be here, and we're going to walk by Mr. Gupta. So we all just walked past Mr. Gupta, got in our 16 Jeeps and left his hotel. He had no idea where we were going. And then we went up. It took us hours and hours to get up. And it was a very scary ride, actually, kind of on icy roads and no protective railings on the roads. And so we got up there and we checked in, and the girls were in one bunkhouse and the boys were in another. And we had the most wonderful time you can imagine. We all cooked together and campfired together, and it was the sweetest part of the whole trip, thanks to Mr. Gupta. So we didn't get to the thanks part right away. It took us a while. First we fired him. I was instructed to talk to his boss about what happened, and Mr. Gupta got fired. On the way down, the little story, from Sandakpu, Gurudeva turned to his driver and he said, this is amazing. You're so skilled. We know how dangerous this road must be, and yet you're managing it, navigating it so well. You must have been up and down this road 1,000 times. And the driver looked at him and said, "This is the first time, this is the last time." He was scared to death. But we didn't know that, fortunately, until we were almost down the hill, that our lives were in danger the whole time. But that's an example of what? Of how something that looks like a tragedy, looks like it's going all wrong. I mean, to me, when this first started unfolding, I was really scrambling, because I thought I was going to have a lot of trouble with this as the coordinator. And yet it turned out we had meditations with Gurudeva up there that we've never had before or since. One reason is he loved the high altitudes and loved to meditate in those high altitudes. And he taught some very special Shum portraits from up there. And it was a gift. The whole thing turned out to be a gift. And you've all seen these little gifts in your own lives and those you know too. Don't need me to tell you about them. They'll tell you a story of in the monastery on Kauai. A couple of years ago, they shut off the reservoir water. Some of you know that by following Taka. And they're repairing the reservoir once every 100 years. And so all of our streams and waterfalls dried up and became mud holes. But when they did it, when they started it, they came to us and they said, "We're going to shut this off. It'll take us about 8 weeks to repair the reservoir, and then we'll turn it back on." So we prepared for 8 weeks. And we got the koi in the deepest ponds so that they could live. And I moved some of the lotuses out of the drier parts into the other parts. And so we thought, okay, we can survive 8 weeks. So then 8 weeks became 12 weeks, and 12 weeks became 20 weeks, and 20 weeks became 36 weeks. And after 2 years, things got really bad. And all we had these beautiful koi, these Japanese carp that must have been 100 years old. And they started dying and dying and dying. At one point, there was a pile of dead koi about this big that the monks were pulling out of the ponds. It was so sad. So I started complaining in my mind to the people, "Why did you tell us 8 weeks when here it is over 2 years and now these poor fish have to die?" So complaint isn't a friend of mine. I don't get along very well with mental anguish. So I started hearing myself complain about them, and I thought, wait a minute, what would Gurudeva do? How would he transmute this problem into an opportunity, a gift? And I thought, and then I thought some more, and I thought some more, and I thought, well, I know. Because there's no water in the waterfalls in the streams, this is the time to build more waterfalls. The perfect time. You can't build a waterfall when the stream is flowing. It's impossible, it just all floods away. But when it's dry, you can build waterfalls. So I got busy, and I got a budget from Bodhinatha, and I hired an excavator and boulders. We dug some boulders, and we made 3 new waterfalls at the monastery. And they're quite lovely waterfalls. They're simple, you know, they're homespun, but they're very nice. And then they turned the water on, and all these new waterfalls were there as that was the gift card. So because Gurudeva taught us, okay, you take something that looks like a problem and transmute it by your reaction to the problem into something that's good, something that's a gift. You see a theme rolling through these stories, don't you? Yeah. So then I thank the people. I could thank them. Thank you for the waterfall. Instead of mentally criticizing them, I was grateful to them for doing that. And then that made me happier, because that's a more pleasant place to be, right? But here's a similar story. Some of you know this story. Well, there was a cult that moved next door to us in 1978. Kind of a strange, quasi-Buddhistic, messianic cult. And they didn't like that we were ringing our bells every 3 hours during the day to rejoice in the divine presence of the universe. And they came over and they said, you know, you have to stop ringing your bells. Because we said, well, when you bought the place, you knew that you were moving next to a Hindu temple, right? Well, yes. Well, we have Hindu temples ring bells. And they said, but our leader can't meditate when the bells are ringing. I didn't say this, but I thought to myself, then he can't meditate. Anyway, I didn't say it. So they didn't get any relief from us, so they basically went to the county authorities and said they have to stop their bells. And it turns out there was no sound laws on our island, and still aren't today. And so the county, I'm over time, aren't I? Am I? No, I'm okay. So the county started holding some hearings. And the hearings grew, and acoustic experts were flown over from New York, from San Francisco. Lawyers were flown over. We got into this big, big fight with them. And it was really unfortunate. Bodhinav and I were sort of the point men for the whole thing. So we were going to all the hearings. We were doing the depositions. We were consulting with the acoustic engineers, and it was constant. It was every day. And we were sort of getting worn down a little bit. And their lawyers were really mean. I mean, they were the tough guys. And so Gurudeva saw that we were getting a little bit frazzled by their efforts to stop the bells. And so he said, okay, here's what we're going to do. And he got all the monks together. So he said, this cult next door is hammering us, throwing their lawyers at us. Next thing, they'll try to sue us. They're doing everything they can to get at us, and we're not going to let that happen. So what we're going to do is we're going to take this energy. He says, everything's energy. Now, this is a negative energy, admittedly, but still it's energy. And we can take that negative energy and we can make it into positive energy. We can do something with it. And so that's what we're going to do. So I had all the monks together, and he said to me, he said, now, Ganapati Kulam, you create a project that all of us can participate in some way. Every single monk needs a job. And we're all going to do something together to take this energy into a creative project. So I got with my team and we developed a plan to do a little booklet called Know Thyself. Have you seen that little booklet? So Know Thyself was the first thing that my Kulam ever did that was in full color. So we'd never done that before up until that time. And so we gave assignments to this monk would write the chapter on the eternal now, and you'd write the chapter on the guru, and you would design a little border on the bottom, and you would design this page, and so we got all, and so everybody piled in, and we worked for about 7 or 9 days, something like that, on this project. And then we sent it off to the printer, and it came back. And Gurudeva brought all of the monks back into the same room, and he sat down, and he held up Know Thyself. He said, see? Now, if they hadn't complained about our bells, we wouldn't have this beautiful little Know Thyself book. So now we can all say thank you. And he made us say thank you to them. He also told me and the monks, I don't want you ever to talk to them again. Which I haven't said a syllable for 25 years or something to them. But that's an example that he's teaching us of transmutation. And that was done on kind of a larger scale, but that could be done on a smaller scale in our individual lives too. Somebody brings us some kind of grief, you know, we'll go in and plant a new garden in the back, or we'll repaint our kitchen, or we'll reupholster the furniture, something, you know, that we can do that takes a negative energy, creates a positive thing that would never have existed otherwise, and that is good enough that we can say to the person, well, thank you. And then on our side, the karma of it is released. It still exists on their side, but we're not holding on to the negativity of it anymore, if we can genuinely say thank you for that. So, I'm going to read a short thing from Gurudeva, and then maybe we could have 5 or 7 minutes of if we want to just ask a question or something. So here's Gurudeva's words on how to face your karma. If difficult things are happening to you and your mind is disturbed because of them, and you have mental arguments within you because you can't accept your own karma, go to the feet of Lord Shiva in the temple with your physical body and beg for the intelligence to place yourself firmly on the path of Sanatana Dharma. Though it is true that we must work through all aspects and phases of past actions, there are ways of becoming excused from the punishments that drastic actions of the past impose upon the future. These ways are grace, sadhana, tapas and atonement through penance and the performance of good deeds, acquiring merit, which registers as a new and positive karma, alleviating the heaviness of some of the past karmas. As the seeking of the self commences, the karma unfolds in all of its hideousness and all of its glory. To be seen before the single eye and not reacted to, even by a tremor, with this physical and astral nerve system, the yoga must be that strong. Each time you blame another person for what has happened to you, or cast blame in any way, tell yourself this: this is my karma, which I was born to face. I did not come into a physical body just to blame others for what happens to me. I was not born to live in a state of ignorance, created by an inability to face my karma. I came here to spiritually unfold. I came here to accept the karmas of this and past lives. I came here to deal with them, to handle them in a proper, wonderful, and intelligent way.
Yay.
Any questions?
The quiver you talked about.
Yes.
My understanding is that there should be both negative and positive.
Yes.
Only negative.
No, it's the positive also. Yes. All of this, the total sum of karmas. Either I did really well or I did really bad. Beth? Oh, what happened with the lawsuit? We compromised by baffling the bells somewhat. We refused to stop ringing them, but we did agree to soften the blow a little bit, and then that's what happened.
Is that why we don't play that machine that at the Arctic time?
Yeah.
Because I was wondering all this time.
Yeah, exactly. We play it, but we don't play it too early or too late in the day. Got it.
We talk of laws of karma. If you talk about the law in the universe, gravity or thermodynamics, it's got a certain pattern of action and mathematics to the system by which it works. In the law of karma, how does it operate? Is somebody writing it down? The person writes it down. But how does it work? How is my past karma linked to me to be operating now? Is there an energy field or is there something else that works to operate this and make it function?
I'll give you my answer, but it's just me. My answer is that you are the whole thing. That there's nothing else outside of you. And you have created a body for your expression and your experience. But the you that's full and divine is not in this, can't be contained in this body. It's the whole universe. And therefore, you are writing it down. You are managing the force of it, the law of it, yourself. That there's not another force doing it. But I do think, my own opinion, I do think it's mathematical. In other words, I think that all of the laws, including the law of karma, have mathematical expressions and form. I don't know if that answers your question, but it's my best try.
Stemming from that, if I am everything, who are these people?
We are you. We are you. That's what happened to Gurudeva when he first met Yogaswami. And Yogaswami said, I am in you. And then Gurudeva said, and I am in you. And then Yogaswami said, and you are in me. And Gurudeva said, and you are in me. And what they were saying to each other in that moment is exactly this. The presumption there, I think the error in that discussion, as I understand it, is that karma is only created by other karma. But right, but I think that's the error of the thinking, that, well, who created the first karma? Because karma, only karma creates karma. But I don't think karma creates karma. On this plane, that does happen and appears to happen. But as you're rightly saying, the crafter of all of those arrows in your quiver is you, is Shiva. They weren't put in the quiver because of something done prior. That yes. That we can't choose everything that happens in our life?
Yes, but in a way, are we choosing everything that happens in our life? We haven't, if it's like Yoga Swami said, it's all finished long ago, and I look at it all as I and you and you aren't, we're all one. But I'm choosing it, am I not balanced, I'm not continually balanced, like there's a point.
Well, you're looking at it more profoundly than I was talking about it. You're right. We're choosing it, and when I say we don't get to choose everything, that's from a very external frame of reference. You're right. We do choose all the things that happen to us. Yes.
There's a collective consciousness of human mankind, if you would. And if the Native Americans say the world is out of balance, and they're trying in their own way to help bring back that balance. You gave examples of individuals and then some of the group. And on a larger scale, the totality of what we live in this planet. How would you
Do you hear his question? Yeah. He's asking, on a larger human scale, how do we bring balance back to the world? It's one of the prime goals of the Native Indian people to bring balance to the world, to the universe. So he's saying, what would we do to bring that balance about? From my experience, which is limited, the best way is by having a genuine balance right here in ourselves. And I'm of the mindset that believes that if one mind is in perfect harmony, in perfect balance, that's the best model and force toward other people finding balance. Because you need a model, you need an example, you need to see that it's possible to have a balanced, joyous, illumined life. And so I think everyone's best gift to humanity is to find that balance themselves. Yes.
How do you control instinct?
Oh, how do you control the instinctive mind? You're a brave questioner. You are a courageous questioner. As I often tell someone who asks me a question that that particular time. Vivekananda said, the time is short and the subject is vast. But maybe at one of the other classes we could delve into that. I think my team probably wants me to halt here. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahanau Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadi Tamashtu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.